Mark and the group is on to something because you have a bigger turnout than the land degradation talks did. Who would have thought soil taxonomy was that popular? So the fragipan, the bane of a soil scientist. What I'm going to talk about is rethinking how we define the fragipan. So I'm going to go a little bit convoluted route and not tell you what a pan is first. The genesis of fragipans, subsoil diagnostic horizon, can occur in many different parent materials. And the key is that they're all transported parent materials, but they're not young. Okay? And why they occur in various different parent materials has been explained in different ways in well over 100 papers by this point. Early on, Fitzpatrick in Scotland tied the fragipan to permafrost. This is an idea the Russians liked a lot. In fact, they think the fragipan is an indicator of permafrost extent, which in America would mean permafrost goes down to Louisiana. Chuckle. Other people think of it as a collapse of a water-saturated deposit, and this is a very popular hypothesis, and it applies well even to lussel soils. Then you have folks who think it's more of a desiccation crack phenomena. Now, the difference between these two is the water-saturated collapse people are largely glacial people or lus people, okay? And desiccation crack people are looking also at that collapse of a water-saturated deposit, but more specifically at these things called prisms that can occur in some pans, not all. And then you move to the Midwest, and you start looking at more specific processes dealing with clay adding strength, and even some cementation, okay? And the cementation can occur from a variety of processes. The point is, for different parent materials, we have different theories of formation. So one of the first problems a lot of us recognize with the fragipan is this concept of trying to capture lots of different things, and that's probably its biggest weakness and why it's so hard to agree on the field that we actually have a fragipan. And so on the left here, you would have a typical Pennsylvania fragipan with prisms, and the prisms here occur, shoot myself in the eye with this thing, you can see, oh, these looks better on my screen. So this is a pretty decent fragipan in colluvium, and then you have another one, not so good. But you get this typical, what they call fragipan brown, as I don't know if Chokas or Smek used to call it that, but that's what Chokas taught me. Finding that boundary and that one on the right is hard, right? It's not as clear because you don't see where the prisms are on the left. But you can get fooled because those prisms can be deceiving. They're not necessarily where the fragipan begins. Teaching students this is very difficult, okay? There you see a good example of one with that fragipan brown across the top of the pan there, okay? And in some cases, that fragipan will be very distinctive because it's perching that water. But it doesn't always perch water, okay? Here you see a classic one from some old Wisconsin glacial till. This is Bill Waltman back in the 70s working on his thesis work with Ed Chokas. And this is not the typical fragipan for most people in the United States, but this is the model that was really being driven early on by the Cornell group. Okay, there you see if you excavate the top and look down on that fragipan, that's what it would look like in that classic glacial till soil. So in this world, this is a barely pedogenic soil horizon. I mean, it's just a hop skipping away from a toddler. Okay. Where they occur? All right, so Dylan Budditt, my co-author, he's the GIS whiz a lot of us work with on this committee. He produced some maps showing where this Wickean at the Great Group extent. Okay, so fragipan kicks in taxonomically at the Great Group as a diagnostic subsurface horizon. Fragic soil properties, which is not diagnostic, that kicks in at the subgroup. Okay, only 2% of the lower 48. Okay, not a very extensive soil. Mostly ultisols and aphisols. Okay. 61% of these have a water table issue. Okay. Which means to me it's perch and water, and that's what's important to identify in the field. 33% of these are typic. Okay. Which means what are they capturing? You know, what's the genesis, what's the model they're trying to capture across the United States? If we look at the subgroup extent now, we see that we have a very small extent. Pennsylvania doesn't even acknowledge that these suckers exist most of the time, but you could argue they're everywhere, okay? Most of them occur in ulfosols and alfosols, 84% of a water table. Easy peasy. We can nail these just off the depletions, right? In one sense, I'll argue the Frangipane is an insignificant soil horizon, and it shouldn't even be described most of the time because none of us can agree on it anyway, but that's what's important to capture are the water table depletions. 16% of these have just a Fragi subgroup. So let's look at the rules. If I asked all the pedologists in the room to define the Frangipane without the rules, we would have a wide variety of answers. But this is what our official rule book says. 15 centimeter thick layer. You have to have some pedogenesis within the horizon or on the faces of the structural units. You have coarse prismatic structure, columnar, blocky, or massive.
Can't have rain.
And you have separations between the structural units over 10 centimeters apart that allow roots to enter. Okay? But massive. Sounds like glacial till. Air-dry fragments of the natural soil fabric will slake. You have to have over 50% of the matrix that does that. And 60% of the volume, 60% or more of the volume is of a firm or firmer rupture resistance class, a brittle manual failure at or near field capacity, and virtually no roots. It doesn't say no roots. It says virtually no roots. But what's that mean at near field capacity? You're just below the gravitational potential of that soil. That's a really wet soil. I don't think I've ever seen a soil brittle at near field capacity except in glacial till. But the roots are interesting. Okay, the Frangipane technically can have some roots in it, but should have almost no roots, but it can have some. And most of the time, those roots are going to be between those large structural units, and it should not fizz. That would kick us into that concern about having perhaps a calcic horizon. So let's look at some of these specifics now. All right, that consistence definition with manure of failure is interesting. If we turn to the Good Field Handbook, version 3 here, we have a nice definition for what this means, and we look specifically at our area for moist. We have very firm classes here that we can actually now quantify thanks to Bob Grossman. Okay, most of us won't do this in the field, but we were taught how to do this in Las Cruces, New Mexico in the last field tour, using either a scale or a burn victim rehab pressure pinch gauge, okay? But this is possible to do, okay? The Brittle manual failure is interesting. I think this is an editorial error here. If we look at this rule set from the field handbook, there is nothing in here that says anything about the soil being at or near field capacity number one, okay? All we get is that typical rupture pop type of adjective. If we look to the soil survey manual now for the definition of manure or failure, okay, we're looking at a soil in a slightly moist or dry state, and if coherent, is nearly always brittle. Nothing about being at or near field capacity. So where did at or near field capacity come from? Probably none of us know, because one of the things we've run into in this committee is we don't have enough written down about how people got to these ideas, like oxyacquic. Right? So we go to table 3.9, referred to in the soil survey manual. And still we're left wondering, where does this come from? So nothing about at or near field capacity. So somehow someone added something in, maybe to try to tie two old keys together or two other aspects. So we look further at these required characteristics, and roots are a significant problem. Okay, you technically can have roots in the pan, but you shouldn't have many. Okay, and you're looking in these zones between the structural units or within the matrix. All right, now, most of the pans in the published literature will fall within the range of these three groups of classes, and this chart here comes from literature that was mined by the NRCS and produced within the Urban Soil Handbook, or what's that called, the Urban Soil Primer, which looks specifically at what bulk densities in the soil may or may not affect root growth. Okay, so for these soils, we're looking at 1.6 or 1.7 to 1.8. All right, so 1.6 it might, 1.7 to 1.8 it will, okay? We'll start with Pennsylvania, a data set generated by Gary Peterson. We identify the appropriate soil texture classes and then start looking. All right, so we should be looking generally within this range here of the silt loams, loams, and loams. So we're looking really around 1.6, okay? Barely potentially root restrictive, okay? Definitely not root restrictive, okay? Now we go to Dave Limbaugh's days of his thesis with Peter Vinneman. Here we have some nice data. Oh, this is actually your doctoral work. Sorry, jumped ahead. This is your doctoral work, okay? And here we have research that was done along the Mississippi River, and we're looking largely now at the silt loams. And we see that most of these do not fall in anywhere near the potentially root-restrictive class. Okay? Certainly not root-restrictive. Now we'll go back to your master's days with Peter. Okay? And we're looking largely at the sandy loams because we were doing work in New England at the time. But there's not supposed to be any fragipans there. But this is before we all erased the fragipans in New England, and that was a large effort by a lot of soil scientists out digging holes everywhere. And we find that, again, the bulk densities are not quite near root restrictive. So what is being identified with this definition that we have? Okay, and why are we mapping it? Yes, the fragipan does affect land management to some degree, but the shallow water table is worse, and what matters most are depletions that are associated with it. That's the thing we clue in most of the time in the field with a farmer or an engineering site or a septic evaluation. Okay? And that's a very obvious thing to pick up in the field, is where that drainage problem occurs because of that pan. All right? So one solution to deal with this problem of not correctly identifying a pan in the field, assuming we even know what truth is, or getting more people to agree at least on what we're looking at, is to turn to fragic soil properties, which in the Keys are essentially the concepts driving what a fragile pan is. All right? But they don't quite have the volume requirement, nor do they have the thickness requirement. The rules are, for fragic soil properties, that you have to have pedogenesis within the aggregates or on the faces, that the peds will slake, okay, that you have a firmer rupture resistance class when you have a brittle, and you have a brittle manure failure when the soil is at or near field capacity again, although we don't know where that comes from, and that there's restriction for the entry of roots into the matrix when soil water is at or near field capacity. What? Why is fragic soil properties more restrictive than the fragipan? So, I propose that we replace the diagnostic criteria now used in a pan with that used for fragic soil properties. You still describe the horizon as an X in the field. I believe this will greatly increase field call agreement among podologists and result in many shorter soil judging meetings among the coaches. It still captures what we are now describing and mapping, and it results in a more honest representation reality. I think the fragipan is an example of regional overconfidence bias, okay, where we have this idea that's been precipitated out by the podologist that came before us, perhaps, over what we think in our area we should be looking at as a fragipan. And I think overcoming this problem of overconfidence bias and regional bias is a real challenge in soil science because there is a subjective nature to some of what we're doing. But the point here is to move beyond that so we get rid of this problem of subjective probability and we make our calls more representative of what we're seeing in the field, at least, even if we don't quite understand all the different processes resulting in what we see. Okay? So this, I think, is the key goal, is to minimize this subjective probability problem we're having. If you really believe the horizon is root-restrictive, I see no problem with using a D. Okay? The D is used for physical root restriction. It indicates a non-cemented root-restricting layer, so it works well for the new fragipan model. Examples of these materials are given, but they're not restrictive to other parent materials. There's no reason why you can't use this outside of tills. All right? You can even use it in anthropogenic materials. So the D, I think, is an appropriate tool to use if you really want to note something is truly root restrictive. With that, I will conclude our search for the fragipan, or as we call it in Pennsylvania, the imagipan. Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. Now we'll have time for questions. So I guess we'll start with Patrick, and we'll work backwards. Questions for Patrick about the fragipan.
Larry. Larry.
So when you were doing your break root percentages, my memory is there are like 30% of soils with fragile break roots that didn't have evidence. They didn't follow the aquifer.
Right.
So what does this do to those soils?
Nothing. You would still describe it as fragic soil properties. My point there was I was originally looking for a way to get around the fragipan as a whole. So do we even need it? Because if it's identifying just a water table condition, what do we need a frangipane for? But there are a percentage of these soils out there that some people say are root restrictive, but...
My only comment to this, and this is anecdotal, so I'm not going to expect my life, but, you know, I've seen soils that don't have high density where you can see that root turn laterally on top of it, whatever it is. But it's not dense. So
but is it wet?
So there's something there beyond just density that's preventing the root proliferation.
Okay, yeah, so were those EX horizons I've heard about?
No.
Okay. Because I heard about these EX frangipanes. I've never seen one. But I suspect they're root restrictive because they have high aluminum. It's not because they're dense.
Yeah. This was physical. They're not that
acid.
Okay. Other questions for Patrick? Frangipane.
Dave.
All right, I've got to say, so I agree with Larry. A lot of the fans that I study in the Mississippi Valley area, they have low bulk density, but the roots come down, go lateral, and go down the cracks. So, what I'm finding, you want to call them a BTXD, that works, but it's not.
But you're going to
have to dense, don't assume that it's a high density.
Yeah, you're going to have to get rid of the density concept of the deep.
The other thing you could just say is punt and say it may or may not be root restrictive.
Okay. All right. Anything else for Patrick? In the back.
You mentioned on frangipane criteria that it had to be 6 inches, 15 centimeters thickness.
Yeah.
If it truly is a frangipane, if you're about to breed a frangipane, and it's 2 inches thick, and it's restricted water, restricted root growth,
Oh, I think there's a lot in taxonomy where there's no scientific basis for why.
It felt good at the time.
6 inches.
It was 5 o'clock that day.
Yeah. All right, Doug, one last one.
I just want to make a comment on the moisture. As soil dries,
Oh, yeah, that's why we call it the imagipan in Pennsylvania, because every spring and fall they disappear. And then they come back in the summer. They go south.
Questions for Curtis? More than 100 authors.
Curtis, since you invoked the Guy Smith interviews, I believe he said that when you look at the soil, you immediately know the soil climate. But in reality, we just look on a map or model prism data what the soil climate is. Is that something that's not being taught? Is that sort of the disconnect with soil scientists now that they don't recognize soil climate when they look at a profile?
Well, you're talking about imagination. Soil climate is invisible. And an argilla, a really well-developed argillic horizon is visible. A petrocalcic horizon is visible. But soil climate is a measurement. It's like base saturation or cation exchange. It's not one of these things you can do in the field. It requires additional data.
Other questions or comments for Curtis? Nikki?
Well, just to clarify, I think some of the proponents who are advocating the so-called taking out the soil moisture regime, they don't mean that totally. Aren't you still going to have aerosols where it would enter into at the order level? And then wouldn't we still have moisture regimes at lower levels in the classification?
Is that question addressed to me or Mark?
To you.
Well, but I think it really is his proposal.
It's Mark's question.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I wouldn't say it's really my proposal because I think we have a lot of proponents for that. But I'll address the question. The proposal that we have right now does not remove the aridic moisture regime, so it does not take out aridistars. Now, a lot of the talk that I've heard since I've been here is why don't you take out the aridistars? So, but the proposal that we have been discussing does not remove aridistars.
And then, of course, the follow-up is why? I mean, if we're getting rid of the soil moisture or we're removing them, why stop with the aridisols?
Oh, that's a good question.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
Other questions for Curtis?
Yes.
Good comment. I really like moving it. Some of the moisture regimes at the family level, you can keep it in the higher orders at some level for aerosol. But, all right, soil taxonomy is a way to organize the soil pedime classification, right, which is useful for small plots of farmers' fields or biological activity, which is really driven a lot by moisture regime. So I've worked in Africa a lot, and in the semi-arid areas, they make classification of their land much finer than the soil natural resource conservation service is on frequency and duration of flooding, which you could capture, but not on one site visit. And that has real implications on use and management of those soils. And then in the semi-arid areas where I work here in Arizona on Valley Fever, the extent of the pathogen that's what can be lead in painful sickness with death and a painful death is really driven by soil water potential or water activity, which defines its limits, but what you have right now is not very useful. And I think USARS has worked out some maps which do not fit at all with the endemic areas. So if you could record in like a soil series level about, that was a beautiful image you had about the aridisol or the arid soil, about it's very rarely you get saturated or field capacity soils in this climate here. And those are really important in defining microorganism growth and distribution. So, and if you could take those into account in your descriptions of soil series, that would be really helpful in terms of utilization.
Good point. Yeah, thank you.